This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's been said that tree planting has mind-blowing potential to tackle the climate crisis. Billions more trees, scientists have claimed, could remove two-thirds of all the carbon dioxide created by human activity. But does it matter which trees are being planted? So in a report released at the end of January, scientists from the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, RBGQ, and Botanic Gardens Conservation International, or BGCI, have said that planting the wrong tree in the wrong place can actually do more harm than good. And they have devised 10 golden rules for reforestation around the right tree, right place principles to maximize the benefits for people and the planet. Here to share more about that is Dr. Paul Smith, the Secretary General of the Botanic Gardens Conservation International. Welcome, Paul. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Lovely to be here. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us. So Paul is joining us all the way from the UK, a very wet and kind of dreary morning, you were saying. But before we get into those 10 golden rules that I mentioned earlier, can we know more about the work that you do? So I understand that you were trained as a plant ecologist and you are a specialist in the plants and vegetation of Southern Africa.
Yes, that's right. And I actually started out, would you believe, as a safari guide. I realized that there was a lot of information about the mammals and about the birds, you know, and a lot of books and so on that people could refer to, but almost nothing about the vegetation. And in Zambia, where I was working in the Luangwa Valley, there are magnificent trees. Mm-hmm. And there was no tree book. So, you know, I wrote a small field guide, and that really got me into doing vegetation survey. I was then asked to do a survey of a national park in Zambia. And I was, you know, given a Land Cruiser and 4,500 square kilometers to map. So
wow,
that's the way I learned my trade, really. And then that led to a job at Kew.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you are, of course, now the Secretary General of Botanic Gardens Conservation International, as I mentioned earlier. But prior to your appointment, you were head of the Royal Botanic Garden Kew's Millennium Seed Bank. Can you tell me a bit more about your time there?
Yeah, sure. I was there from 2000 when the seed bank opened, and initially as a coordinator for Southern Africa and Madagascar. And that involved doing seed collecting and coordinating seed collecting in those areas. And then in 2005, I applied for the director job, the head of the Millennium Seed Bank, and was successful in that. So I was head of the seed bank for 9 years. And, you know, the whole premise for the Millennium Seed Bank is less about a doomsday vault and putting seeds away for the next 100 years in case of Armageddon. Mm-hmm. It's much more about learning, you know, how we can manage and conserve wild plant diversity. So the Millennium Seed Bank partnership, as it is now, and we changed the name in 2010, you know, comprises, well, hundreds of seed banks all around the world that focus on wild species, learn how to germinate them, learn how to reintroduce them, you know, how to recover those species. Mm-hmm. And that's actually quite pertinent to the discussion we're going to have about right trees in the right place, because there's an awful lot of knowledge now about those wild species, how we can grow them, how we can reintroduce them, and how we can manage them.
Exactly, yes. And I guess, you know, for anyone who's unfamiliar with, you know, the places that I just mentioned where you are working as, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what Botanic Gardens Conservation International does.
Yes, Botanic Gardens Conservation International is actually the world's largest plant conservation network. But it's a professional body that oversees, advocates for, builds capacity in, provides professional standards for the world's botanic gardens. Now, botanic gardens are different from, let's say, historic gardens or municipal gardens, because they're based on science. And really, science, conservation, public engagement are the three main areas of botanic gardens that they specialize in. And that means the collections in botanic gardens, the plants that you see when you walk around the gardens, you know, we have scientific information about where they came from, when they were collected, and so on. Mm-hmm. So there are about 3,000 botanic gardens in the world. We have 650-plus gardens as members of BGCI, so have a very strong conservation focus. Mm-hmm. We coordinate the Southeast Asian Botanic Garden Network, actually, which includes gardens in Malaysia. We provide, if you like, our mission is to mobilize botanic gardens for plant conservation. So we provide a hub. We train thousands of people in vocational training, in setting up nurseries, in everything to do with plant conservation, and also engaging with the public. Mm. You know, 750 million people visit botanic gardens each year. So that's a big chunk of society. And that gives us the opportunity to talk about the importance of plants, to talk about sustainability, you know, the way that we use energy, water, food, etc., and reach a lot of people, hopefully. So that's our mission. We have that central point. Our headquarters is at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew in London, but we have offices in the US, in Southeast Asia, in China, in Africa, and so on. So, yeah, we're really there to support botanic gardens around the world.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you say that you also do a lot of on-the-ground work with regular folk, like I suppose me, you know, is that how you also operate? Like if anybody has questions, they want to set up something in their own little community or whatever, you are open to offering advice?
Absolutely. And you know, I think that's a really important point, because it's not just about botanic gardens. It's about how botanic gardens can use their skills, knowledge, data, and so on, working with broader society. And they all do. That's why I mentioned the visitors and so on. It's not just visitors, though. There are community groups and so on. So we've also led the Global Trees Campaign over the last 15 years, which is about conservation action for highly threatened trees. And that's primarily working with local communities. We bring in botanical expertise from the institutions, but the people who care for these species have to be the people on the ground in those communities where the trees are found. Yeah. You can bring in expertise to help train people, but the people who need to care for those trees are right there. So they're our primary focus.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's an exchange of ideas, you know, from when you go and meet the communities, they can probably tell you things about, stuff that's found in their areas as well, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. And they also have, of course, will have knowledge about the use of those species. They'll often have cultural importance. There are those elements. What we find, though, quite often is that there isn't necessarily a tradition of growing them, because they've always been found in the wild. And now that they're becoming scarcer and scarcer, if we can help with horticultural skills, for example, and enable people to cultivate those species, to reinforce populations, to even, to cultivate them so they can use the fruits or medicines or whatever it is those trees provide, then those are skills that our horticulturists can contribute. It's very much an equal exchange of knowledge. As I say, the critical knowledge is actually in the community.
That's right, yeah. And I suppose, it's been a tough year for us all. How has the pandemic affected, the work that BGCI does? Has it had an impact at all?
It's had an impact on our training. We've tended to do face-to-face training. So we run training courses regionally, within different parts of the world. And we'll often bring expertise from other parts of the world. So that has, we've been affected by that. On the other hand, we've been able to get on with quite a lot of things. For example, we lead on the Global Tree Assessment, and that's a huge international effort to assess the conservation status of all 60,000 of the world's tree species. And that is largely a desk exercise, using data which is available on those, and then the expertise, people who know these trees in the field, will review the conservation status, whether these are threatened or not, and what's causing the threats. So we've largely been able to carry on with that. Some of the fieldwork has been affected for obvious reasons.
Okay, all right. I'm speaking today to Dr. Paul Smith. He is the Secretary General of the Botanic Gardens Conservation International, or BGCI, which is the largest plant conservation network in the world. And we are actually discussing a paper that was released in late January, which kind of sets out some golden rules, for reforestation around the right tree, right place principle. And we're going to come back after this quick break and find out what those 10 golden rules are. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me from the UK today is Dr. Paul Smith. He is the Secretary General of Botanic Gardens Conservation International, which is the largest plant conservation network in the world. And we are discussing, how tree planting, is often portrayed as an easy answer to the climate crisis, but a new review that has been led by BGCI and also RBGQ, which, has some issues with large-scale tree planting. So, Paul, I guess, everyone is doing some mass tree planting. Malaysia has also said we need to plant 100 million trees. I think UK has, all these similar goals and things like that. And yes, of course, it is necessary. And I just want to be clear about something about this paper. You are not saying that tree planting is wrong. Am I correct?
No, we're not saying it's wrong. We want to encourage people to plant trees. We love trees, but it's just about...
You're in the wrong job otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, there's a number of things that the 10 golden rules, most of them should be obvious. And I think, so the first one, for example, is not to cut down old growth forest. And, one of the really the problems that we have is that on the one hand, we're cutting down old growth forest that sequesters and stores carbon. On the other hand, we're planting trees to sequester carbon.
Boggles the mind.
Yeah. And according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN in their report last year, we've cut down 50 million hectares of old growth forest over the last 5 years. That's an area the size of Spain, nearly twice the size of Malaysia. Mm-hmm. We can't keep doing that because also, as we plant trees, A, we're not keeping up with the amount we're cutting down, and B, we're not replacing like for like. We're putting in largely monocultures, exotic species that do not have the biodiversity benefits that natural forest has.
Yeah, that is a severe problem here in Malaysia, because forest cover here also means monocultures and things like that. So it might look rosy in terms of the statistics of the data, but actually, as you said, we're losing our natural rainforest and, which Malaysia has so much of and which we've also lost almost 50% of as well.
Yeah, and, we're also making the point for biodiversity here, and there's a number of the rules in there that point to maximising biodiversity. If I was to take an example from the UK or from Europe, Quercus roba, the English oak, which is native to the British Isles, is host to over 2,300 species, other species, birds, mammals, lichens, fungi, insects, and so on. So for every oak tree that you plant, you are supporting, over 2,000 other species. The same is not true if you plant a eucalyptus or if you plant an exotic pine. They are largely sterile landscapes. So there's a big, big knock-on and a big plus for the rest of biodiversity if you plant a native tree.
Yep, definitely. And, just looking at the other rules, you've also said, you need to put local people at the heart of tree planting projects. I suppose that talks, is a little bit of what we were discussing earlier, but maybe you can elaborate on that.
Yeah, I think, one of our concerns is that some of the large-scale tree planting, whether that's government-led or whether it's led by large corporates who are trying to offset carbon and so on, is that these things can be imposed on, local communities and so on. And there's been a lot of noise, in the media and in the scientific literature about the right places to plant trees. And there have been some sort of sweeping generalizations that we can plant trees in, that there are, millions and millions of square kilometers available for tree planting. And the obvious question is, have you asked the people who live in those areas? And, to what extent are you working with those communities? Are those resources accessible to them? And so on. So again, it's common sense, but it doesn't always happen. And that's really why we wanted to put something in a single paper, so that this could be something that would be used for guidance, no matter who you are.
Definitely. I think, you know, often, especially if I can say here in Malaysia, you know, a lot of we have our native communities living in the forest, and, you know, all the objections that they put forth or all the sort of knowledge that they have is lost when they are forced out, you know, when forests are degazetted, you know, and they're forced to leave. And so much knowledge is lost, and there's knowledge that you can't get back, and the biodiversity that's that right. you mentioned. Yeah. Yeah.
Once it's gone, it's gone. And the same is true for the tree species themselves. And, you know, I mentioned that we lead on the global tree assessment. Well, you know, we have so far, we've gone about halfway through. So if you look on IUCN's red list, there's about 30,000 tree species on that list now. We've been adding about 10,000 a year over the last couple of years, and that will continue. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you look at how many species are threatened, we're somewhere around 3,000 critically endangered, so they're about to become extinct. Mm-hmm. I have a list of 445 species that are down to fewer than 50 individuals left.
Gosh.
Literally a handful of trees for those species. Once they're gone, they're gone. And all of the other species, as I say, that rely on those trees for their own life cycles, for shelter, food, and so on, they're gone as well. And that's why we're absolutely determined that no tree species should become extinct. There's no technical reason why they should. And this is why we need to intervene.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Let's walk through some of the other points. One of the other golden rules is to select the right area for reforestation. Can you help explain that?
Yeah, well, that also sort of speaks to our earlier point about not, for example, you know, imposing on local communities without working with them first and understanding what their needs are, but also not causing harm to biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, some of the initial maps that were published actually even in the scientific literature suggested that there were vast areas of savanna that we could be planting trees in. And our point is that those savanna areas and other vegetation types that look like they might be good for planting trees are actually highly biodiverse themselves. They provide ecosystem services and they should not be displaced by monocultures, by large-scale tree planting monocultures, because you will be making other species extinct that way. And, you know, that's nobody wants that.
Well, except plantation owners, I suppose. But unfortunately, yes, no, definitely. And, you know, the other thing, the other point that was brought up in the paper was, of course, to select the right tree species that can maximize biodiversity. So that goes to the point that you were saying earlier as well.
It does. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that there are around 60,000 tree species in nature. We plant just a few hundred through forestry, through large-scale forestry. So you will know them. There'll be, you know, Australian eucalypts, grevillea, Australian acacias, a few Indian acacias, Africa acacias, etc. Pine. In the UK, it's spruce, so Sitka spruce. And, you know, those are a tiny, tiny proportion of tree diversity. Mm. Now, in the world's botanic gardens, and we maintain a database of what is grown in the world's botanic gardens, we cultivate at least 18,000 different tree species. So, as I say, technically, we can do this. And in fact, we have a program at the moment in Malaysia working on the conservation and cultivation of dipterocarps, you know, which are so important within your forests there. And in a growing those so that we can learn how to cultivate them. And I think there are propagation protocols for maybe 60 or 70 at the moment, but we need all of them. Mm. So this is something that botanic gardens can help with. And we're actually just setting up a consortium of botanic gardens and arboreta around Asia that will specifically concentrate on all the dipterocarps to make sure that we know how to grow them. We know how to reintroduce them. We know how to carry out species recovery for them. So that project is underway. You know, we have funding for that. And that, you know, that will give us the tools that we need to be able to grow a much wider palette of dipterocarp tree species. The idea is all of them, so that, you know, that foresters can use those. We can use them in ecological restoration and so on.
Okay. Wow, that's an excellent initiative. And as you said, that is an ongoing thing. You've got the funding for that. Okay. Excellent. So we need to catch up with you on that when we have more on that. But just going on to the next point, and this, of course, is an important one. We need to make sure that the trees are resilient to adapt to a changing climate.
Yes. And there again, you know, botanic gardens can help with that. I think there's one of the ways that we can do that is that we can assess how well species grow in different climates. I mean, botanic gardens themselves, as you know, grow a wide range of non-native species. So they're perfect laboratories, if you like, to see what the climatic tolerance is of various species. Mm-hmm. And as a general rule, trees in particular, because they are long-lived organisms, are much more resilient than we think. And the problem with some of the academic modeling, which is carried on, that takes a wild distribution of a tree and then infers from that this is its sort of climatic tolerance, is that that's often not the case. They're often much more, have much wider tolerances than that. We know that from botanic gardens. Mm-hmm. So we keep records, as I say, for all tree species that are grown in botanic gardens, including how well they grow, whether they need extra management like irrigation and so on. And using that information, we can predict with some accuracy, with a great deal of accuracy, you know, how well a particular tree species is going to do under future climate scenarios. In fact, we have a tool under development at the moment, which has been led by the University of Tasmania and Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria in Melbourne, which does exactly that. It you put your species name in, it takes all the records that we have of where that grows, not just in nature, but also in urban centres, in botanic gardens and so on. And against different climate change scenarios, it predicts how well that tree is going to survive, you know, over the next century. And that's hugely helpful if you're planting trees now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess, you know, everyone should sort of make use of that tool because everybody is planting tree initiatives, right? I mean, this is a great way to start when you are deciding on what you want to do.
Absolutely. Yes. If you want your tree to still be there in 30, 40, 50 or 100 years' time,
yeah,
then, you know, you do need to understand what's going to be happening with the climate and also, you know, what that tree can handle. So that's exactly what this tool is designed to help with. And of course, botanic gardens and arboreta are ideally placed to, you know, provide information on that because it's exactly what we do.
Mm-hmm. And just going on that point, you know, actually planning ahead is also one of the golden rules that you have mentioned in that 10. And of course, you know, you said that it's always best to work with local people as they are the important sources of labor and expertise when you are planning. Am I correct?
Yes, I can give you a really good example. We were contacted a few years ago by a community in Bhutan in the Dangchu Valley, and they were concerned about they have a tree species there which is used for building monasteries. They had the largest population remaining in Bhutan. But because it's important, you know, for Buddhist temples and so on, they had no control themselves as the local community over what was cut and what wasn't. That was dealt with by central government. And they were concerned that these trees were being cut down and not replaced. So they contacted us and said, look, can you help us to set up a nursery? So we did that. And we actually brought out some specialists from the Royal Botanic Gardens, Edinburgh, to help with the seed collecting and setting up the nursery and so on, which they did. And the nurseries were set up to produce 20,000 seedlings a year of this for the community. And because the community was planting those and had, you know, put the land aside, because the community planted those trees belonged to them. Mm. And we said to them, you know, this is a long-lived tree and that, you know, they grow to a huge, huge size. And we said, well, you know, when do you expect to harvest this tree? And they said, well, we estimate maybe in 85 to 100 years' time. So they weren't thinking about themselves, not even their children or their grandchildren.
Yeah.
They were thinking in the long term. And I think it's wrong to suggest that all communities and local people, you know, that the immediate sort of economic driver is their only incentive. Clearly, there was great pride in this tree, which, as I say, is culturally really important, but also great concern that they had no control over its management into the future.
That's amazing. And that, I think, you know, flows quite nicely into the next rule that was, highlighted by you and the authors, which is learn by doing. And you said that the best planning decisions for tree planting schemes are actually made when scientific knowledge is combined with indigenous knowledge.
Yeah. And that, you know, that was the case in, here. And we lost, a number of those seedlings initially, because they hadn't been planted in the right place. Mm. We had livestock issues. If you've got cattle or whatever, then keeping livestock off your young trees is really important. So there's a whole range of sort of community based elements there that need to be managed and balanced, and there are trade-offs. And all of that knowledge and all of those perspectives need to come together, in any sort of land use practice. Mm. And that's why it's impossible to not work with local communities. You just will not get the outcomes. And what really works best, as I say, is if the impetus has come from the local community itself. This can't be imposed. And in this case, in the Dang Chu Valley, they had come to us and said, can you help? Mm. And that, that's what we need. That's the best kind of model that there is out there.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that is something that you are open to, of course, right? That the Botanic Gardens and Conservation International is open to anyone approaching them and anyone asking them for advice.
Yes, and it's important to be clear that we are a secretariat, that we're there to represent and connect people with their local botanic gardens and that expertise, which is locally based, which again is appropriate. This is not a top-down parachute model. Mm-hmm. So we're a conduit and we get requests for information, contact details, and so on all of the time. In fact, to try to make that more effective, we're just setting up a directory of expertise that anybody will be able to search on by geography, by discipline, etc. So if you want to find a tree planting expert in Malaysia, you can do that through our directory of expertise, or an ecological restoration expert, or a seed conservation expert, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. To try to mobilize, there are 60,000 horticulturists and scientists within our network.
Wow.
That is a tremendous asset, but we need to make sure that those people are out there helping broader society to solve some of these problems. And so we need the tools to do that. And BGCI has a pivotal role in that. That is, I see, as our most important role.
Okay, excellent. And, the final golden rule, of course, is to make it pay. What do you mean by that?
Well, this making it pay doesn't necessarily mean dollars in your pocket. There's a very interesting kind of movement, which I'm sure you're aware of with your program, around natural capital accounting. Mm-hmm. And that tries to weigh up really all of the benefits to society rather than just, let's say, the timber value of a tree. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was about a decade ago now in England, the government tried to sell off the public forest estate. So this is, 250,000 hectares of forest that belonged to the public.
Oh, wow.
There was outcry about this. And the Bishop of Liverpool at the time was appointed to lead a commission on this. Part of the work that they did was to get a consulting firm in to come and look at the value of the public forest estate. And they published a report that showed quite clearly that the value to the public, that there were a number of elements to it. First was recreational value. A lot of people use that forest for exercise and so on. Aesthetic value. So people will pay more for a house if it's got a forest view. There's biodiversity value. There was carbon value. There were a whole range of values that sat way above the intrinsic value of the timber in that forest. Mm-hmm. It's really important that when we carry out these kind of make it pay evaluations, that we take into account all of those elements, not just the value of the dead tree. And I think that's what we mean by making it pay. That's what we mean also by working with local communities and understanding the importance of that forest and of those trees to those communities.
Mm-hmm. I just want to quickly ask you about this study, right? It was a collaborative effort. I guess I just want to know, how did you and the authors and, you know, everybody involved, the scientists involved, come up with these 10 golden rules? I mean, what did you sort of look at to come up with these, I guess, best practices as such?
Yeah, it's a review paper. So, you know, you'll see that there's a lot of literature cited in there. So we've been looking certainly at, you know, at other published information to do with pre-planting, tree conservation, restoration and so on. So it's really a synthesis of the science, but also the practice. You know, there's a lot of experience that I've mentioned, you know, some of the programs that we're involved with and have been over the last few decades. And, you know, what I think one of the issues with the scientific literature is that it can be too academic and people are not necessarily grounded in practice.
Mm-hmm.
Where I would argue botanic gardens are different from, let's say, universities, and of course there are many university botanic gardens, but really as a sector, is we don't just have the scientists, we also have the people who can grow these plants, and they're called horticulturists. But they're also out there working in broader society and particularly working in areas like ecological restoration. And that means we sit between research and practice. So there's quite a lot of practical knowledge in there. And actually, you know, we have a conference, a reforestation conference, where we've got speakers from all over the world, including a lot of practitioners with their practical experience of large-scale tree planting, with their practical experience of biodiverse tree planting and ecological restoration. And I'd encourage people to watch that, because I think that's our particular strength, is being able to bring in practitioners as well as the academic, the sort of the scientific thinking. Yeah, it's all on YouTube. If you Google Reforestation Conference, BGCIQ, then that will come up.
Okay. All right. Excellent. So we'll definitely keep an eye on that. I guess, you know, just to conclude, Paul, what are your hopes, you know, for these 10 rules that you've set forth, you know, for this? It made headlines all over the world, which is wonderful. I think people like those bite-sized sort of like, you know, pointers to follow, right? But what are your hopes? You know, who do you hope will use this and continue to, I guess, use these ideas that you have set forth?
Well, we've been encouraged by the number of practitioners who've come to us and said, you know, we like these rules and we will try to do our best to adhere to them. It's fair to say most of those are NGOs and, you know, working at small scale. I think we would also like to see, you know, this taken seriously at the policy level.
Mm-hmm.
So this conference has specific sections which are aimed at the financiers of large-scale tree planting and restoration. And also policymakers and planners who are setting the rules. And, you know, if you just look at the Bond Challenge, 350 million hectares pledged, or at least that's the aim.
Yeah.
What are we? I mean, 70 countries, I think, around the world. You know, when that boils down, you look to actually what is actually happening to meet those pledges. There's very little of what we have suggested is best practice. We need to shift that needle. So I'm really hopeful also that the new global biodiversity framework, which is sort of coming through the Convention on Biological Diversity, I'm really hopeful that we can get rid of some of these perverse incentives related to the Climate Convention. I hope the two conventions will work together. And, you know, what we've created here is a body of scientific work as well. So it's all justified, but bringing in some practice. So I'd really like to see that adopted by policymakers as well, you know, those principles.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big ask, but, you know, we have to start somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, we've all, you know, agreed to all these different things for the Paris Agreement, and we need to actually start working on it. And this is and we've all agreed to have some amount of forest cover. This is an excellent guideline, right, to follow if you want to do that.
We believe so. And as I say, it's grounded in excellent science. And, you know, that science is coming from the botanical community, because one of our other concerns is that, in fact, the way that I've described it in this conference, in the opening address, is to say, for those of us who work in plant conservation, it's as though all of our buses have come along at once. Mm. With the, you know, the tree planting, everyone movement and so on. On the other hand, there's the realization that we might not be on any of those buses. It's really important that the botanists, plant conservationists and others are part of the planning and part of the practice. Otherwise, we're not going to get good outcomes.
So everyone needs to get on that bus. And, if anybody would like to get in touch with you, Paul, you know, if they'd like to collaborate in any way, what's the best way that they can do that?
Through BGCI, our website is there. Just email us. That's always welcome. As I say, we have requests for help, working together and so on all of the time. That's exactly what we do. We will connect you with, our network and whoever's local to you and help in any way that we can.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much for joining me today. Any last message that you'd like to leave us with?
Plant trees. And don't cut them down. I think those are the two key messages.
The right trees at the right place.
Plant the right trees in the right place, exactly.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Dr. Paul Smith. He is the Secretary General of Botanic Gardens Conservation International, which is the largest plant conservation network in the world. And we were discussing, some best practices for large scale tree planting. It's not, tree planting is often portrayed as the easy answer to the climate crisis. But a new review that was led by RBGQ and BGCI highlights some issues with it. And that's what we were discussing here. But if you missed any part of today's show, you can always download the podcast at bfm.my/earth, or you can find us on the BFM app. And as Paul said, if you'd like to get in touch, just head to bgci.org and you can get in touch there. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.